All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? What is happening? Today on the show, I talked to David Krumholtz. You definitely know this guy. I feel like I've known him my whole life. He's been acting since he was a kid. Lots of people grew up with him from the movies like The Santa Claus and Adam's Family Values, The Slums of Beverly Hills. He was on the shows Numbers and The Deuce, and most recently he was in Oppenheimer. He's in a new movie called Lousy Carter, which is great. Great showcase for him. But he's one of these guys, Krumholtz, where I'm like, you know, how am I not going to get along with that guy? We seem like kindred spirits. And we did. We did get along. We're different, but we understood each other, and it was good to see him. I'm kind of perky right now because, once again, I realized that this show is my life, and this show can dictate how my day goes, how my week goes. I just did an interview in here with somebody that many of you don't know, probably. Some of you do know. You know, it was an engaged conversation for an hour, like I do here, and that's what, you know, my life is. That is the nourishment of my life, is to just sort of, you know, be as open as possible most times. Sometimes I'm a little defensive. Sometimes I'm a little bullying. Sometimes I'm a little soft. There's a lot of different variations of who I am on a soul level. And it all comes out here with these people who, most of which I only have one conversation with. And it makes my heart and mind and life better. This job, talking to people in a way without expectation, to get to know them, to hear where they're coming from. No agenda. It's a very beautiful thing. And for some reason today, I feel that more than others. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, April 3rd. Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th. Chicago at the Vic Theater on Friday, April 5th. Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 6th. Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center. Glenside, Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater. Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. Munhall, Pennsylvania outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall. Cleveland, Ohio, May 10th at Playhouse Square. Detroit, Michigan, May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. And just added this week, Sacramento on November 8th at the Crest Theater. There's a presale going on right now with the password All In. One word, A-L-L-I-N. General tickets on sale tomorrow. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my dates and links to tickets. Can you dig it? Yes, I can. I did something the other day that I realized, again, not talking about age in any negative way, but one of my favorite shirts, one of my Ship John shirts, one of my button-ups that many of you have seen because I've worn it on many different shows in a long time. For some reason, when I'm in a creative zone, I walk around with a notebook. Look, I have a notes thing on my phone. I could use that, but I walk around with a notebook and I stick it in my breast pocket and I stick my fucking pen in there. I got a very specific type of pen. And this is not like something I haven't done before. I stuck it in there. I went to see a show last night. And then when I got home, I realized, oh, okay, my pen was open. And now my shirt is fucking ruined and there's nothing I can do about it. Now, there's a lot of things you can go through in your mind. You know, who the fuck puts a pen in their pocket? Who the fuck even carries a pen anymore? What the fuck is wrong with you? Why don't you get on board? Why don't you fucking wake up, dude? You have all the technology in your hand and the monster. Yeah, you got the charged monster right in your fucking pocket. Just write with that. You can't even read your own fucking handwriting. What is this old ass tradition of yours that requires a pad and paper? And it's good questions. These are good questions. But there's something about the way I engage mentally with a pad and paper. And I got to be honest with you, I can barely read my fucking handwriting. It's a decoding process. I've talked about this before. There's no reason for it. It's the same with Post-its, pieces of paper. For some reason, this is still the way I work, where everything is just a pile of scraps and notebooks where I have to figure out what the fuck I was thinking and why I wrote something, why I wrote what I did. And what is it? What is that word even? So now, it's been a while since I ruined a shirt, but I ruined one of my favorite shirts. And I'm a big boy. I can take the hit. I don't give a fuck on some level. I do. It was one of my favorite Chip John shirts, one of my favorite shirts in general. And now I just got to live with it. It's irreplaceable. Is this going to be enough to get me to forego the pen, get rid of the notebook, change my process? No. I don't know if you know this about me. There was a time where I knew this would happen. It was probably after the last time I ruined a Filson shirt and then ended up with three of them. I ordered pocket protectors from Amazon. You know, those plastic things you put in that you can stick pens in. And I ordered them. And for a while I had it in my pocket. And then I realized, like, well, to really use a pocket protector, you're going to need more than one pen. You should have, you know, a few pens in there, maybe a pencil and an instrument used for drafting or engineering. It was too much. The demand of the pocket protector was too much. And here I am. Here I am again at a crossroads with a permanently stained shirt that can only look like one thing. There's no hiding it. It's just sort of like, hey, stupid, what? You didn't close your pen? But you know what? I'm going to go back to it. It's just, you know, it's just the way I am. I'm dug in, people. So, all right. Look, this is kind of exciting because I'm able to announce Bad Guys 2 is happening. Bad Guys 2, Mr. Snake. Mr. Snake is going to be back. I think it's slated to release in the summer of 2025. I feel like we've already recorded most of the movie. But because it's not COVID, we could all be in the same room together, which was pretty fun. And DreamWorks is very close to my house. It's a great job. But we laid out a lot of the script. It was great to get together with everybody, the crew, and then the actors. So in the studio, it was me and Craig Robinson and Anthony Ramos and Awkwafina and Sam Rockwell were in New York on Zoom. And we kind of, we did the business. And it was a blast. It's fun to be able to read with the cast in real time. We did some riffing, I imagine that's the way it used to be done back in the day. You know, now because of technology, you can just go in and record your part with someone else reading the other parts and that'd be the end of it. But this is really makes for a better animated experience, I think, if the emotions are connected. And I don't want to spoil anything. But, and I'm not going to. I did, Natasha Lyonne and I, she's also in the movie, and we were able to hammer it out one-on-one. I hadn't seen her in a while. And it's good fun. And I'm happy that I get to announce that, not only are we doing it, but I feel like a lot of it might be done. But you kind of go in, they tweak things and you do other things. But it was a fun movie. And it's coming back. And I'm Mr. Snake again. Yeah, Mr. Snake. I'm back. So that's fun. Figured out some hooks. It's so funny because I started doing something that, you know, in the script that kind of becomes, this signature thing that I just got from the way Kit says this word, and now it's in there. I was like, I'm going to use it like that. Anyway, it's fun to do that kind of work, and it's happening. So look, you guys, I'm excited to present to you now my conversation with the intense and thoughtful, and this guy's a character to me. And I'm glad we hung out because I feel like it was supposed to happen. David Krumholtz is in a new movie called Lousy Carter. It's a dark comedy. I enjoyed it. It comes out tomorrow, March 29th, in theaters and on digital on-demand platforms. It's a unique movie. And this is me and David Krumholtz talking now. Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? Well, for me, honestly, it's my stereo system. For years, I've wanted this stereo system. And then at some point, I realized, like, hey, you're saving money. Buy it. So I got a pretty top-of-the-line, tube-driven stereo system. It has changed my life. It's not only great for listening to music. It's great for me to sit there with my guitar while I jam or just rock out. Because when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. Just like the all-new Lexus GX. It has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Available dynamic sky panorama glass roof. Available front row massaging seats. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires. And available multi-terrain select system for off-road driving. Ability. Any of these options will help you take your Lexus GX to the limit, just like I did with my stereo system. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcast. There you are.
Hey.
There he is. You're the guy from The Thing.
From a lot of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too many things.
Do you get
predictable
that?
Predictable shit.
No, it's not predictable.
No.
But I mean, as a character actor, I would assume maybe you consider yourself that to some degree, or just an actor.
No, that's the whole idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that means you kind of sign up for being like, you're that guy.
I guess so. You know, I like to think that my face has practically been sewn into the great American pop culture quilt at this point.
It has.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're an American tradition.
That's correct. some would say treasure. I'm the Peter Lorre of my
treasure.
Day. I'm the Peter Lorre of
you?
My day. I believe so. The whole idea is like to do anything.
Yeah.
Is to be able to do anything. You know, I don't like this whole pigeonholing and branding shit that goes on, you know.
Who does that happen to in your mind? What are we seeing outside of the pantheon?
Well, people brand themselves. It's not like it happens to them, you
right?
Know? I find if you stay long enough in Los Angeles, in particular, you kind of got to do that because that's what people expect. I knew from a very early age that if I did that, it would be great, and then people would be like, "Oh, we've had enough."
You started so early. I mean, it's hard. It's amazing that you didn't. It's amazing you avoided that somehow. In the way that when you start as a kid, and you are that kid, then you're going to be that kid until you're not a kid anymore, and then people are like, "What happened to that guy?"
Yeah, but I knew what I could do. You know, like I knew I could do. My dad was a really talented guy who had no idea that he was.
What did he do?
He was a mailman in New York City for 30 years. He worked
the
night shift. Yeah, he had to go to work at 3 a.m. every
morning.
So
he was at the post office or
The Murray Hill post office and delivery.
Okay.
He'd box mail and sometimes he'd actually go deliver it.
Did he enjoy it?
No. Fucking miserable. It drove him crazy. I mean, it drove him crazy. But, and he was a neurotic, you know, mess.
Yeah.
He was the rhesus monkey with the wire mother. I mean, he was all fucked up.
Yeah.
But he used to do a lot of accents.
Yeah.
He could do, like, you know, he liked for you to do, give me an act, give me a region.
Yeah.
You know, Italian. And he would do, like, you know, or he'd do impressions and shit.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, I can do that too. And I want to do that.
But he was also entertaining to you.
Oh, dude, my father was, God bless him, man. First of all, he was dumb.
Yeah.
He was dumb, which is great.
Is he not with us anymore?
He's dead as a doornail.
Yeah.
But he's dumb, which was awesome.
Yeah.
Get yourself a dumb father.
My dad's becoming dumb.
That's great.
And he's only smart in one way, it turns out.
There you go. A lot of people are only smart in one way.
They happen to be a doctor, mm-hmm. but the rest of it was garbage.
There's geniuses out there who are total morons.
Yeah, totally.
No, my dad was a very simple man. He was intimidated by responsibility and by life in general.
That's a good way to put it.
And whereas he was a very funny person who understood comedy,
yeah,
he really... he was unintentionally outrageously funny and the butt of every joke, and so much so that my entire family sort of would talk behind his back about the stuff that happened to him and how he would react. There's a thousand stories, but I'll give you one.
Yeah.
If you want to hear one. It's a quickie.
I enjoy it. Yeah.
Okay. Just to give you an idea of what kind of man this guy was.
We have time. I mean, we got to fill this time, Dave.
First of all, he got shit on by birds more than anyone I could even conceive of. As everything. I personally alone in my time with him saw him get shit on by birds at least 12 times.
Doesn't that mean he's lucky?
No, because he ended up dying of a rare neurological disorder and suffering really badly.
That whole thing about being shit on by birds, that's bullshit then.
Bullshit.
Okay.
At least in my dad's case. Yeah. But things would happen to him and he had no sort of a self-awareness. He just had none.
Yeah.
And one time, just for an example, and there's a thousand stories, but one time, obviously, because he's my dad, right?
Yeah.
But one time he called me and he said, he had custody of me on the weekends. My parents divorced when I was 2 years old. My mom broke a frozen steak over my dad's head, domestic violence, blood.
With the steak?
With the steak, yeah. So blood. I remember, it's my earliest memory.
Them getting in the fight with the steak.
Yeah, and watching my mom like crumble to the floor after she did it, and watching my dad like bleeding profusely from his head and calling his mother and saying, I've got to get out of here. And that was how it ended. It's very sad. But
it is sad. Did you stay in touch with your mother?
Oh, yeah. There's no choice. All right. I mean, she'll be homeless if I don't. God bless her. I love her. She's a good person now.
Yeah.
took 45 years. No, 40 years.
40.
Yeah. Learning curve. But anyway, he called me and he said, hey, you want to go to this Israeli restaurant that opened up? And I'm like, no, I don't want to associate with my Jewishness, and which is true to this day. And I don't like Mediterranean food.
It's you don't?
Ugh.
That's the one you don't like?
No.
Mediterranean.
Mediterranean.
It's so simple.
It's disgusting, in my opinion.
What did this to you?
I don't like a lot of shit.
But which Mediterranean food would you be like, that's that?
Well, Greek food turns me off in a major way. But if we're getting specific, it's the spices, man. And everything's very dry. The meat is very dry. You know, they don't believe in medium rare, which is bullshit.
Mm.
Anywho.
Yeah.
He goes, hey, I'm going to this Israel. Want to come with me? I'm like, no, that's all right. I'll pass. He goes, okay, I'm going to go. And then I'll pick you up afterwards and we'll have a day. As we did. And so he goes, he comes in, he picks me up and he says, you're not going to believe what happened to me. And that was kind of, you know, if I ever wrote a biography of my dad, it would be, you're not going to believe what happened to me. Because things would constantly happen to him.
Yeah.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
And mind you, I'm like 9 and I know my dad is a mess. And
right.
It's so funny. And, I'm able to take real joy in it and appreciate it. He goes, I was eating the rice they gave me, and I bit down on something really hard, and I spit it out, and it was an olive pit, a pre-eaten olive pit in my mouth.
Left?
What was left of the olive was in my rice somehow, and there were no olives in the dish.
Yeah.
And he said he told the waiter, and the waiter was like, you must have put it there or some shit.
Sure.
And he was really pissed off about it. Now, my grandmother... Mm. His mother. He lived with his mother in a one-bedroom apartment till he was 36 years old.
Huh.
And my grandmother was a wickedly funny person, wildly broad, just a super, like a comedian that never, like an unrealized comedian.
Yeah.
She was that for our family. She was ballsy and mean.
What was her name?
Her name is Martha.
Yeah.
She was ballsy and mean and just a prankster, just a wicked, sarcastic bastard of a person who was also wonderful. And her prey, her number one victim was my father. She loved to fuck with him. I mean, yeah. She used to like pretend to draw a portrait of him and make him sit still and like yell at him if he moved his face.
Yeah.
And then eventually she, like after like 20 minutes, she'd turn the portrait around. Yeah. It would just be a picture of a dick and balls.
And
she would do that to her own son.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
Because there was, when I was younger, I worked at a deli.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this old Jewish guy yeah. that worked at the deli who barely spoke English. Uh-huh. And he'd always go, well, I'm going to draw you a picture.
Yeah. And he would do that?
He would do that.
It's a joke. It's such a funny bit, man. Yeah. I've done it to people. But yeah. So she loved to fuck with him. So I said, upon hearing this Olive Pit story, yeah. I said, you got to call grandma and tell her the story. Now, this is before cell phones. Yeah. We lived in Forest Hills, Queens, which is a commuter neighborhood.
Yeah, I know where it is.
Tons of, like, you know, buses and trains, subway stops, and major subway.
I lived in Astoria for years.
Okay, so yeah. At any moment on the corner of any major intersection, Forest Hills, there's got to be 30, 40 people just walking in and out of work, coming back from work, whatever.
Yeah.
And there was a payphone booth on the corner there, right by the train station. And I said, you got to call grandma, tell her this story. She'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah.
So what ensued was he calls my grandmother, and I'm watching him, and all I see is this. And I know my grandmother's fucking with him, but all I witness is him going, telling the story, and then going, yeah, and there was an olive pit in my food. No, not an olive pit, the pit. Not an olive pit. Olive pit. The pit! And my dad, who is a big guy with a large booming voice,
yeah.
started screaming the word olive pit over and over and over in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
Olive pit! Not a pit, an olive pit! not the olive pit! Olive pit, the pit of the olive! And again, no awareness. And people... on the street or like, stop. There's a man screaming.
Yeah. Olive pit.
Olive pit.
Yeah.
And I'm standing there and I tell you, I was bent over, you know, like you just hit the floor. And if I tell you that happened constantly with my dad, these things, the shit that happened to my dad, it was so funny.
Yeah.
And he had no clue.
I think there's got to be a Yiddish word for that.
I'm not sure. I don't know what it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The guy who gets is the brunt of everything.
A Stick Fleisch mit zwei Augen. Just a piece of meat with two eyes. It was amazing. He was riotously funny.
But not on purpose, per se.
Never, barely ever on purpose. And...
that's a tough position.
But it was great because, you know, it made it so that I'm attracted to really sort of viscerally funny belly laughter comedians. Like, clever comedy is fine. You know, the UCB improv, that kind of stuff. It's also referential and clever and God bless it.
Right.
But I like Brother Theodore.
Sure. You know, did you go see him?
I never saw him. No.
Oh, he's right in the village for years.
I know, but
you were alive.
I was young, though. I was quite young. Yeah,
yeah.
He might have been too depressing. I might have missed the joke at that time. But
I think he's probably a lot like your father. I don't think he necessarily always knew he was being funny. I think he someone told him he was funny, and then he just did it in the context.
No, I think he was being him.
Yeah,
yeah. That's who he was, which is amazing.
Yeah,
that he lived that way with that mind. But that kind of stuff, like, has always been the funniest stuff. I don't care your witty reference.
Sure.
I could give two shits about.
You just like,
make me guffaw. Make you know.
Right. Well, there are guys that are you know have no choice.
Correct.
And those are the funny guys.
Right.
Or guys who are I'm always very, I like physical comedy when it's natural,
mm-hmm.
when it's not thought about. There's some guys that they cannot be funny.
Correct. And, born funny.
Yeah, just even in movements.
Yeah, and then crazy. Once they sort of realize their power, then it's like off to the races. You know, like,
yeah.
Tracy Morgan to
exactly.
me.
Exactly. Yeah,
is
sure.
like crazy funny.
Yeah, and a lot you of times know? He doesn't even make sense.
Right.
Yeah, it's good.
Right. It's just it's just him being
like
a character.
But you like someone like Rickles.
Oh, through the roof.
Yeah.
I mean, probably my favorite. I saw Rickles four times in Vegas.
You did?
Yeah, four separate
when
times.
When he was still standing?
Oh, yeah. No, he was jaw-droppingly funny.
I watched some of the old guys, you know, and the thing about Rickles that was amazing and probably why you liked him is that he'd go out on Carson. And from the get-go, he was flailing.
Right.
Like he was already failing and just throwing for the fucking fences. He couldn't, like, it didn't start out clever or, like, you know, he was taking shots that didn't make sense. He was already sweating. He was turning. It was immediately furious panic.
But then what was great about him is then he sort of would call out the audience and sort of say, oh, no, if you don't get this, the joke's on you.
Sure.
You know, you're the butt of my jokes right now because you're not understanding what how way ahead I am.
Way ahead. And, you know? And he would... I talk about it a lot. He would say things that made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the timing. Yeah. You're laughing, and then you don't even think long enough to realize, like, that didn't even make sense.
Right. I met him once when he was decrepit.
Yeah.
And I told him I loved him.
Yes.
And I was hoping he'd be funny, but he was too decrepit to be funny.
What did he say?
He just said thank you.
Oh.
And was nice.
One time, I'm a comic, right? So one time I met Jackie Mason.
Wow, I met Jackie Mason too.
I didn't like him.
You know, I love Jackie Mason.
I don't.
You don't like him as a comedian?
Nope.
Oh, I disagree with you.
Well, that's fine.
Not because I'm Jewish. Like, believe me, it's not. It's
no, that's exactly why I don't like him.
Because what?
Because I'm Jewish.
Yeah. No.
And see, there was something about him, the way
that
he
was too Jewy.
The way he contextualized Jewishness.
Uh huh.
I push back on. You know, because I was not. You know that. I fought against my Jewishness.
Me too. I still do. Sorry. I know. Sorry.
No, it's all right. I don't anymore, but, like, you know, in terms of I talk about it, but I'm not going like, hey, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
But there was something about when I was starting as a comic that this stereotype that he bartered in was annoying to me because it was limiting.
And I hear you. However, on a technical level.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure.
Very good.
Yeah, but
very
good. You know, but like the direct legacy of that technique is someone like Dave Attell, who is fucking much more funny.
Who doesn't have to do that?
Well, he doesn't have to have a point of view other than whatever that weird sadness or thing that he has.
Mm-hmm.
He's a naturally funny guy.
I worked with Dave Attell, and then like 2 years after I worked with him, I saw him in the street and said hello to him, and he had no interest in speaking with me whatsoever.
I've known him for 35 years, and we've had two conversations, and both were on this show, and he had to do it.
Yeah, I can see that being his thing.
But it's not that he doesn't like you. He's not aloof. He's just sort of like...
it was clear. I didn't take it personally.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, but Jackie Mason, so I meet him, and I, you know... The owner of Catch Rising Star, Rick Newman, introduces me to Jackie Mason. He's old, and his hair is a weird color.
And he's a Trumper.
This is before that.
This is before that, okay.
No, this was like in the 90s. And Rick goes, this is Mark Maron. He's a young comedian. And Jackie Mason goes, doesn't look funny.
Nice. What a sweetheart. You know, the thing is, man, here's the deal, though.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the... distancing myself from my Jewishness. Here's the
thing.
You
know you can't, right?
What exactly? Here's the thing. Is like you can pass. I'm looking at you.
I know. Yeah.
You can pass as a non-Jew.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
My name is David Krumholtz.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have the face. I look like I'm basically the next Five-ish Finkel. Like there's no... And so you can imagine how desperate I am to separate myself.
You're almost a racial caricature.
That's distributed
among anti-Semites.
I am the poster, the Nazi propaganda poster. If I can make that face, that, I just made it, and it's very, authentic. For me, look, I'm a proud Jew. Jews are great.
Yeah.
I have no problem with Jews. Other Jews, the only Jew I have a problem with is myself, and I'm very much an American.
Sure.
For better or worse.
I was never
raised religious.
But that's just part of the Jewish cultural experience, right?
You
were raised culturally Jewish. The way you talk and think is probably culturally
Absolutely.
Jewish.
Absolutely. I say oi, oi, oi. I say gavalt and all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't even
stuff.
Do that.
I do that shit, and I hate
Where'd you get that?
It.
From your father? Your mother? Grandmother?
The whole lot.
All of them. Were they?
My mom was born in Hungary, so my family, her side of the family is just straight up immigrant, like...
Like, were they fleeing?
They fled the Hungarian Revolution, when the Russians in 1956.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So they'd lived through the Holocaust.
Right.
And then And then my dad's family were Polish Brooklynites. And so very much in that sort of whatever that's
And
called.
Also New York.
Very schmaltzy.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, and that's sort of like, I mean, I interviewed Carl Reiner once.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, him and Mel Brooks, best friends for 100 years.
Right.
Mel could not be more Jewish.
Correct.
In terms of how he presents. Carl Reiner at some point killed that part of him publicly.
Yeah, I think so.
It's kind of interesting because he wanted to be an actor. And when I talked to him at length, he didn't say that. But it was clear that, you know, when he started, you know, he was not going to be that.
Right, right, right.
You didn't do that.
Well, here's the deal. I don't shy away from it. I need work. I work. If it comes in and it's like a rabbi thing, like, fuck it, I'll do it. Yeah. But I don't love doing it a lot because what ends up happening is typecasting, right? And then they go, hey, go to rabbi, go to Jew is Krumholz, but we've seen him do it in the last five things and we need a new Krumholz to come in and do it. And so I'm desperate to get away from those. Plus, to be honest with you, I could do it with my eyes closed. Playing a Jew is like the easiest.
Sure.
Thing. Yeah.
But there's a spectrum to it. And also, like, I don't know if now, look, when I was growing up, there were Jewish leading men. They're gone.
Correct.
You know, you had Elliot Gould, James Caan,
Dustin Hoffman.
I mean, and then the two Italians, and mm-hmm. that was all of them. Pacino and De Niro, and then the three Jews, four Jews, whatever.
Yeah,
that was it.
You're right.
And right now, like even in comedy, I mean, when I was growing up, the joke I have about it is that, you know, where have all these Jews gone? And I believe that antidepressants killed Jewish comedy.
I don't know. I think I've gotten funnier. I think my antidepressants are like making me way
I'm just fun, saying in a general way.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Kill Jewish comedy, yes.
Because like, you know, comedy was fundamental. American comedy was Jewish and black, and that was all.
And fundamentally, at its core, jokes about depression.
Speaking of
like,
stand-up,
you know,
yeah,
like
sure.
Woody Allen and Richard Lewis and those kinds of people, it was all about how neurotic I am and how depressed I am.
That was the generation after was Yiddish.
Right, right.
It was like more first person. Like, you know, Lenny Bruce, like half of it's, you know, a lot of Yiddish in there. Right.
Making fun of suffrage also.
Yes, yes.
You know.
And also trying to get a foot up or whatever, the leg up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because what were the Jews going to do? I didn't realize till I was older that there were Jewish boxers, like a lot of them.
Oh, yeah. Barney Ross.
Yeah. Max Baer.
Yeah.
Mike, but there was a whole bunch of secondary ones.
Joe Lewis.
Of course. One of the great Jews.
Major Jew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My grandparents went to the same temple as him. but it's interesting because I have feelings about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have you worked with Judd Hirsch?
I've worked with Judd Hirsch, I think three times. One time I worked with him for 6 years. He actually gave me my start in acting.
He did.
He's like my acting dad.
What was that story?
I was 13. I was a normal human being, kid, just to whatever extent. And I
out
had
there
no
in
interest
Forest Hills
in
or
Forest Hills.
Yeah.
I had zero interest in doing anything, much less becoming an actor.
Yeah.
And my English, my like sixth period English teacher was a wonderful man named Lon Blaze. And I had done the school play and he had directed it.
Mm.
And about a year later or less than a year later, he said, hey, they're coming around to schools.
Yeah.
This was a thing they were doing in the early 90s where they'd go to public schools and they were looking for kid actors who weren't like perfect, weren't like trained.
Didn't know the ropes.
Yeah, they had no agent and they wanted authenticity, fresh people. And what they would do in New York City specifically is go to New York City public schools and talk to teachers and say, hey, this is the kind of kid we're looking for. If you think any kid you have is funny or talented, tell them to come down. And there was this Broadway play called Conversations with My Father, this Herb Gardner play that Judd Hirsch was the lead of.
Yeah.
It was to play Judd Hirsch's son. So you kind of had to resemble Judd Hirsch. And my teacher, Lon Blaze, God bless him, he said, hey, there's this role. You should go in. And I thought, well, I don't know what, okay, sure.
Yeah.
And it was like on a Saturday in the basement of a church in New York City in Manhattan. And I remember I went with Billy Eichner because I grew up with Billy.
Okay.
And Billy's so funny. And Billy had an agent and was a professional actor. He sang. He was amazingly talented even then. And we went together, and there was like 1,000 kids. Like the CBS local news was there.
Yeah,
and I was number 88. I got there early, and I felt like, and they said, hey, just read these lines like you're a stand-up comedian. That was the direction.
Yeah.
And I'd watched a lot of stand-up, and, you know, on TV. So that was easy for me. And they called me back 6 times over the course of the next 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And each time there were less and less kids until eventually it became clear that it was down to me and another kid, who happens to be a wonderful comedy director named Jason Walliner.
Yeah, I know that guy.
Really good dude. Well, so he was the other kid. He was a kid actor. Yeah, and I had seen him on like commercials, Saturday morning cartoon stuff. And I was like, oh shit, he's going to get it because he's a pro.
Yeah.
And I went in and Judd Hirsch was at the final audition.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I did my thing. It was a very dramatic play. And Judd Hirsch said, you're a really good actor. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever, I guess I am. And then I left, and they didn't call for like 3 weeks. Ugh. And I thought, oh, that's gross. Like, yeah. I just spent 8 weeks auditioning for this thing and getting my hopes up. You would think they'd call at least to say, hey, you didn't get it.
Welcome to show business.
Right. And then they fucking called.
Mm.
And I was an actor on Broadway with a large part in a Broadway, in a great Broadway play, suddenly.
And it was big, right?
And it was big. It ran for a year. Judd Hirsch won the Tony for Best Actor. And yeah, it was just, I was stupid and misbehaved. And I had no idea what a professionalism was.
Right.
I didn't care.
Did you learn?
I did. So much so that a couple years later, they rebooted the play in L.A. And I saw it with Judd and Tony Shalhoub was in it. And who they were all in the original Broadway production. And I just showed up and went backstage afterwards and profusely apologized to all of them. I was just like, I'm sorry that I was so out of control.
Did they feel like you needed to?
No, they got it. I mean, I was out of control, but—
What does that mean?
What did they expect? Just pranking. Oh, okay. Just doing pranks never stopping, like just being annoying.
But there were no hookers or blow.
No, not yet. 14. Not yet. But yeah, you know, I just felt like, oh shit, I should apologize to these people because I really was out of control. But you know, what do you expect? I mean, I was a kid off the street, literally.
But talking about Jewishness, the thing about Judd,
mm-hmm.
because you know, you worry about being typecast.
Yeah.
And
by the way, Judd worries about it too.
He's 95, isn't he?
He's 89.
Yeah.
He turned 89.
He still worries about it?
2 days ago.
But this is the interesting thing about Judd, is that, you know, with Judd, you get the full spectrum of Jewry. You don't,
correct.
You, like, we were looking for a father to play on my show on IFC.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all these old actors, they all are kind of available if mm-hmm. you just pay them. And Judd, you know, everyone wanted Judd. And I said, well, I can't do it. My father's not like, boop, 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 boop. You know, mm-hmm. he's not this Jewy guy.
Right.
My dad's a bipolar fucking nut job.
Mm-hmm.
And Judd is going to do the Jew thing.
Right.
And, but they're like, but they're not working. But I'm like, fine. And we're shooting the first day. And Bobcat Goldthwait's directing. And okay. I got my showrunners there. And, you know, it's Judd's first day as my dad. And he's doing it. He's doing the cute Jew thing.
Okay.
And, you know, and I'm like, he's doing it. What are we going to do? Mm. And the showrunners are like, I don't know. And Bobby's like, you know, I don't know. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? He's an actor.
Just tell him.
Just tell him.
I'm sure he was thrilled to hear, hey, and, well, take the Jew-ness down.
Well, they told him that he's bipolar. He's got an mm-hmm. edge to him. And like that.
Yeah.
Fucking nailed it.
Oh, jumped at the chance, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
He deals with the same thing I do, which is Jew face.
Yeah.
You know, like blatant Jew face.
Right.
And he has his whole career, and they're always casting him as old rabbis and wanting him to do, like, thick accents, and he's like, fuck that
shit. He was the best part of the Fablemans.
Well, because he's an intellect, and he plays the intellect.
Yeah, but also, like, kind of a free spirit. Like, kind of, like, you know what I mean? It was definitely a type.
And I'm sure you got to know him, and that he is that. He's a wild dude.
I didn't get to know him that much.
He's definitely a bull.
Yeah. And he, you know, and you know, it's surprising, you mm-hmm. know, the life he's led. But you know, actors choose acting for a lot of different reasons.
Correct.
A lot of it has to do with you know, not wanting a regular job,
mm-hmm.
living the life you want to live,
mm-hmm.
and getting away with something.
And also ego feeding and
sure.
You know, workaholic type. You know,
is it though?
Torture shit.
Yeah, for you?
For me, yeah.
Because I find that
I work harder when I'm not working on a movie or a TV series or a play. I'm very communicative with my representation.
Oh, okay. So you're like, why the fuck did this guy?
Basically, I live and breathe this shit. I live and breathe Hollywood. You know why? I mean, I got nothing else. I grew up worshiping films, worshiping comedians, worshiping actors. I got super lucky to be that time in that Broadway play. Sure. I got crazy lucky, man. That doesn't happen to anybody. I don't know anybody else that's happened to. So I owe it to the privilege of whatever divine intervention was involved with me ending up an actor at all to like fight my way through this as hard as I can and to live and breathe it. And that's what I do. That's what I've always done. You know,
For opportunity.
For opportunities.
Right.
Yeah.
But when
No. For opportunities, not jobs, for opportunities.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you're on the set, now.
That's the easy part.
Well, I know it's easy for a lot of people, but I can't stand waiting. A lot of waiting.
Well, there's so much waiting in between jobs, though. So by the time I get to a set.
That's like, okay waiting?
Yeah. They tell me it's like 3 hours. I've been waiting 3 months. So that's 3 years. So that's fine. I don't love waiting either. I did a comedy. I don't want to say what it was, but I did a comedy. And, you know, comedies should be shot quickly.
Yeah.
I did this big studio comedy of like 15, 16, maybe 20 years ago. And God damn, the director of photography spent like 8 hours setting up every simple.
I never understand
like,
that.
And I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, where's the momentum? It's gone.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be momentum in comedy. There's got to be.
Did it turn out funny?
In my opinion, not really.
Okay.
But some people like it.
I cannot
say what it was.
I'll tell you.
Because it'll hurt people. I'm trying not to do any harm today.
Really?
Yeah, I could do a lot of harm at any moment.
You kind of went nuts on Twitter for a while, didn't you?
I did. That's why I stopped.
what drove that?
Craving attention.
But do you get to a point where the anger... the righteous anger in your mind and probably correctly is justified. And then, you know, you get on that roll and you're like, I'm doing it.
Here's the deal. It fueled years of my career, that righteous anger, many years. But it wasn't making me that much better an actor.
But didn't it upset your representation? Were you like that on set? No.
No, never. I'm the loveliest person on earth. I'm an oracle. I'm a light. People flock to me. Mm. And it did not upset. Well, it upset my shitty representation early on by, you know, agents who have all quit the business. My first like 5 agents are like not agents anymore. They weren't meant to do this. And I had to work my way around them.
The thing that you know that I didn't learn until later, like I used to do that too. My entire early career as a stand-up, and it didn't get me any opportunities, was me on the phone with my manager saying, how the fuck did he get that?
Right.
Who the fuck is, you know, what?
Right, right, right.
And this is a big guy who was, you know, at a company that produced things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even get a reading.
Right.
So once you realize, like, you're just this bartering tool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like a lot of times you're going to get something because someone's doing your guy a favor.
Right, right, right.
It's fucking awful.
And not only that, but your agent is only getting you the job to impress other agents, not impress you. And once they've got you the job, they can always say they did and they don't have to get you another one.
Sure.
Unless they're creative themselves. And only the last 10 years have I had amazing representation.
All the other guys are gone, the old guys.
They literally quit the business. They got laughed out of the business. I mean, literally. There was one guy that his whole circumstance was crazy. He married a wild woman. She became a reality star. It was so strange. I have fought my way through, and I need fighters on my team because people underestimate or because people want to pigeonhole me. And I knew that from very early on. And it's very hard to convince anyone in this business that you can do anything or that you believe you can do anything and then you can actually sort of kind of deliver most of the time.
Right. But you got to keep them remembering you or else you got to make a lot of money for somebody.
Correct. And it's just about surprising the shit out of people.
Well, I mean, like, would you say that your big break was The Slums of Beverly Hills in movies?
No. I would say The Santa Claus.
Really?
Yeah.
Because Slums of Beverly Hills is great.
Slums of Beverly Hills is when people started taking me seriously as an actor. Because in The Santa Claus was a huge hit, but I played a fucking Christmas elf.
Right.
You know, and people, cute little kid playing a Christmas elf.
Yeah, that movie makes money, that movie.
and it makes a lot of money.
Right.
Slums Beverly Hills was when people sort of said, and that's when Judd Apatow saw me and said, hey, there's something else there that's more than just a kid actor.
Right. What did he put you in?
We did a pilot called Sick in the Head. It was me, Kevin Corrigan, Amy Poehler, Andrea Martin, and Austin Pendleton.
Yeah.
Just a sick cast.
Funny.
Kevin McDonald from the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. It was a multicam sitcom, but it was character driven, and which was different at the time because there was a lot of Friends. You hear the writer's room in every multicam sitcom suddenly, whereas this was like a throwback to 80s multicams where it was like more like character.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Jim Ignatowski would make a face and that would get a laugh
because
you knew what he was thinking or you didn't know what he was
thinking.
And that's the joke. So he wrote this brilliant thing called Sick in the Head about two roommates in LA, and huge response at our taping and it didn't get picked up. It didn't, it was shocking actually.
What year was that?
That was like 1998, I want to say.
And had you been through that before? That sort of incomprehensible kind of confusion and disappointment of like, how could this not?
That was really the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah, where I was like, this is bullshit.
Right.
Everyone loves this fucking thing.
Yeah.
It played really well. What's the problem here?
Yeah.
What's the disconnect?
You know?
And the same year, Judd also produced Freaks and Geeks.
Right.
And Freaks and Geeks got picked up.
Right.
And thank God, because I decided to come out to L.A. and live here on my own and try to make something of myself.
Yep.
And Judd knew I was really, really lonely.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, just come hang out on a Freaks and Geeks set and meet everybody. And those became my dearest friends. You know, all those actors became my dearest friends. Thank God for that, or else I would have gone crazy.
And Martin stars in this new one.
And Martin stars in Lousy Carter. Yeah, Martin is just a precious individual.
He is.
You've met Martin.
I've talked to Martin.
I love Martin very much.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
He means well.
He means well, but also he's like a thoughtful, spiritual dude.
Yes, and he wasn't always that. Martin could be frustrating at times.
In what kind
early
of way?
On. Well, showing up 3 hours late to things. You know, you'd make a plan. Hey, you want to grab lunch?
Oh, that's just personal stuff.
And he'd literally text you, hey, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
And then show up 3 hours later. But he lived like 5 minutes away. And then you'd say, hey, Martin, what the fuck were you doing that took you 3 hours? And he would always say the same thing. I was thinking in the shower.
Well, that's a deep guy.
What are you thinking in the shower, which is amazing. That's the name of his autobiography, Thinking in the Shower.
So within like a few years, I just want to know, like, you know, going from, you know, Judd Hirsch and being in that presence in terms of learning something.
Right. Learned everything in that moment.
And then you get to work with Alan Arkin.
Which is the best. Riotously funny human being. Reminded me so much of my father because deeply, deeply neurotic. But the smart version, the brilliant version.
Sure.
But deeply neurotic man.
Yeah.
And he once told me, you know, when I first met him, we for some reason, me, Natasha Lyonne, Kevin Corrigan, and Marissa Tomei sat around talking about depression.
Yeah.
And Alan said, I'll never forget, direct quote, Alan said, I was standing on a bridge in Nova Scotia looking out over a lake, and I decided I'd either throw myself in the lake or spend the rest of my life working on myself. And... it was just such a revealing thing to say. He was saying, hey, I almost killed myself.
Yeah.
It was on our first day of meeting him. Like, here we are sharing stories about, oh, I was depressed. And here he comes with like, oh, I've been suicidal pretty much my whole life.
Yeah.
And I'm playing the patriarch of this family. And that's such a great movie, that movie.
Yeah.
It's my favorite still of all the things I've done.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think it was going to be amazing. I thought it'll be all right.
Yeah.
And it came out so well. Tamara Jenkins just did an amazing job with it. And it was also a fucked up production. Like, we were a week behind, 2 weeks in. They sent the bondsman to the set. But Alan was... I'll tell you a crazy story.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a lot of Alan Arkin stories, but my favorite one...
I loved him. I never got to talk to him.
I loved him, too. He called me Crumhorn. And I would do the impression for him, and he would say, you can only do it once a week from now on. No, because it's bothering me. He had tics. He had like physical tics.
Yeah.
He was very paranoid about his lines. He couldn't remember his lines. And sometimes when it was his close-up, he'd be like, you know, sitting there going, okay, going through his lines. And I tortured him and I would say, Alan, you okay? And he'd go, I guess I'm okay. Yeah. Why? Do I seem not okay? But one time, so we're the sort of climax of the film is Carl Reiner comes into town, plays his brother. And his brother has been financially supporting the family for years.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah,
for
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
And the scene is we meet in an airport diner, and Alan is once again going to ask his brother, Carl Reiner, for more money.
Yeah.
And Carl Reiner's like, what the fuck?
Right.
It's enough already, don't you think?
Yeah.
So Carl Reiner plays his brother, and Rita Moreno plays Carl Reiner's wife.
Right.
So just amazing day
sure.
on set.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, Marissa's there, and Natasha, and the little kid played by Eli Marienthal, and me. And we sit down at the table with Carl Reiner and Rita Moreno, and Alan is coming. He hasn't arrived. He's the last to arrive. And we're going to rehearse and start the day. And Carl Reiner and Rita Moreno are lovely and exactly what you'd hope they would be.
Yeah.
And here comes Alan, and there's silence, and Carl Reiner, first thing out of Carl Reiner's mouth is, last time I saw you, 30 years ago,
yeah.
you told me to go fuck myself. And then Rita, who worked with him on Poppy,
yeah.
chimes in, yeah, you were a real nasty son of a bitch. Have you changed? Right off the bat. And Alan, you know, it was hard, and we're all witness to this, and we love Alan.
Yeah.
And he's this tortured person.
Yeah.
Alan's a wildly tortured human being, and it was the scene.
Yeah.
But not the scene. It right. was the exact yeah. thing we were about to do.
Emotionally.
Where he's yeah. demoralized and degraded for being kind of.
Yeah.
And Alan sat there and his head, you know, staring at the floor, and he said, I've changed and I'm not the same anymore and I'm very sorry. And that's how the day had to start. It had to start that way. They
right.
had to clear the air.
Right.
You know, Carl Reiner was like, oh no, the first thing I'm going to say to this guy is.
It was in the barrel. It was in the chamber for years.
Yeah, for years. Mm. And then we had a wonderful day. Carl Reiner took us into his trailer and played a demo tape for the 2000-year-old man in the year 2000.
Right, yeah.
It was just me, Alan Arkin, and him listening to, and I was just pinch myself shit.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure, absolutely.
Before it came out, no one had ever heard it.
Yeah,
it was like
yeah.
Carl Reiner just seeing if we thought it was funny. It was incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I miss Alan. Alan yeah. was wonderful. I tried to work with him again. I wanted him to play my father in something I wrote, and he called and he said, it's ground I've covered, so I don't want to do it again. He said, you know, I would do it, but it's ground I've covered. And what, playing my dad? Which was, I think, his way of saying, like, I don't like you at all.
I
didn't
know.
Like working with you.
I don't know.
There was definitely, I annoyed him. I enjoyed annoying him.
But it seems like everybody did.
Here's the deal.
Yeah.
You ever around someone who's such a character that when they're at their full-blown angriest,
yeah.
it's the most funny thing you've ever seen,
yeah.
and you have to hide your laughter?
Sure. That I like trying to get people to that.
Oh,
point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too. That was Alan's thing.
Yeah.
One time we were shooting a scene. Oh, my God. We're in the car, and it's a hot car.
Yeah.
And we're on a process trailer.
Right.
And on the process trailer, the director and the first AD start yelling at each other.
Yeah.
And it's Alan's close-up, and he's trying to remember his lines, like desperately trying. And all of us, and he hears this fight break out, and we can hear it in the car, and it's insane. And Alan just says, will everybody please calm fucking down? This mass hysteria is driving everyone fucking crazy. And bro, I lost my mind, and I'm sitting next to him, and I can't hide it.
Yeah.
I'm dying.
Yeah.
Screaming laughter.
Yeah.
And he's, I'm glad you think it's funny. This is ridiculous. Keep laughing, you know. So, anyway,
that's great.
Yeah, he was wild.
I swear to God, his character in Little Miss Sunshine, like mm-hmm. to me, it's like that's the perfect old man.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's like if I can turn out that way,
mm-hmm.
you know, just quietly doing heroin occasionally.
And here's the crazy thing about yeah. Alan Arkin. Alan Arkin. It was the only actor I've ever worked with
yeah.
at 65 years old, mind you,
yeah.
who bold-faced told everyone on that set, I should have won an Academy Award and I still want to. Now, that's a big thing for an actor to come out and tell other people, I wish I'd won an award, though. Like, yeah, I'm people know who
for
I am.
To Kill a Mockingbird?
And I've done. No, for Heart as a Lonely Hunter.
Oh, Heart as a Lonely Hunter. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
He was like, I should have won. I still want to win. I won't be happy until I win an Academy Award. Yeah. He was so bold-faced. And I thought, wow, that's pretty ballsy of you to like sort of let your guard down and tell people that. He also wanted a Porsche Carrera.
Yeah.
He would see Porsche Carreras drive by and make like a thirsty, like,
really?
Eat, like he wanted
why,
to eat.
Why couldn't he have a Porsche Carrera? Cars.
He was having financial issues at the time. Oh. Anyway, so that when he won for Little Miss Sunshine, he went up and made a speech and he played it off. He kind of played like, oh, this is nice. Thank you so much. I knew that he was fucking thrilled. And
of
that,
course.
And that his dream had come true and that he was good now. He was going to be fine for the rest of his days.
Mm.
He was going to be a happy, satiated man.
That's great.
And I sent him flowers.
And?
He never responded.
Ugh.
That's okay.
You know who else used to like talk about winning an Academy Award? Mm. The guy who played my mom's boyfriend on my show. It's a second tier.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Arkin. Michael Lerner.
Michael Lerner.
Oh, my God. I got some Michael Lerners to write.
Oh, my God.
You?
No, I've never met Michael Lerner, but when I was shooting Oppenheimer, a little movie called Oppenheimer.
You're great.
I know.
It was great. I just love the sort of the chorus of Jew nerds in that movie.
Mm. Yeah, led by Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
but anyway, we're shooting. So Chris Nolan is a genius, a real genius.
Yeah.
There's no dummy. There's no dumb part of him. He is the real thing.
Yeah.
Probably the only one I've ever met.
Really?
And I've worked with some really, 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 really smart people who are considered geniuses, but I would say, in my opinion...
What was the moment that you realized that? Because there is usually that moment where you're like, oh my God.
We were doing a scene in the desert, and we showed up to the set, and it was already amazing watching him. He is the spectacle on the set. Because he never sits down and he micromanages every little thing in the movie. He's the head of every department.
Yeah.
He's not like a director that goes, I'm hoping that everything is taken care of. He takes care of it. And we showed up and I was already enamored with him. He's very funny too. He's super sarcastic and funny. And they had built a windmill and it was windy and the windmill made a little noise when it turned. And he just... It's none of his concern, and it barely made noise.
Yeah.
But Chris turned and said, that's going to fuck us. that noise is going to fuck us. And I just thought, God, this guy's so fucking aware of every little goddamn thing on this set. He's just, he's like a quarterback. He sees the whole field. And anyway, we were doing this scene.
Did they fix it?
They fixed it immediately, yeah. But we were doing this scene where I tell Oppenheimer that I'm not going to come to Los Alamos because I don't believe in building this bomb. And, you know, the craven part of me, I guess, was like, I should scream at him at one point. I should get loud, you know, because I'm, you know.
At Oppenheimer,
and this will be my little.
Yeah.
This will be my little Academy Award moment.
Sure.
And so I did that in the first two takes,
and
Chris Nolan walked over and he said, "It's a bit Michael Lerner, what you're doing." And I thought, "Are you saying that as a negative thing?" And he, "It's a bit Michael Lerner." I said, "Oh shit! Well, I guess I don't want to be Michael Lerner in this moment.
You don't.
It's a bit Michael Lerner.
You might not avoid. Might want to avoid that."
But Chris was such a sarcastic man. I mean, we did the first scene. He does like four takes usually of everything. And he did 14 takes of my first scene's close up. And he walked up to me after. He said, 14 takes, huh? And I said, fucking sorry. And then, oh, dude. And then he fucked with me the whole time. And it took me a while to realize, oh, he's not being serious. He's just fucking with me.
Okay.
He likes to make me, you know, tremble.
He's doing what you did to Arkin.
Basically, he's fucking with me.
Yeah, he wants to see you pop.
Dude, you know I respect that.
Yeah,
I
mean, of course.
There was one day I had to fart.
Yeah.
I was standing next to a sitting Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And they're setting up a shot. There's no stand-ins, so you've got to just stand there.
Yeah.
And man, I had to fart. And I knew it was a bad one. You know, this one's
got a heat to it.
This one's got a heat. And I thought, I can't do this. I cannot fart. But you're not allowed to move off your mark. It's a very strict set. He wants it like a play and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, listen, I'm not going to fart in Robert Downey's face. It's not going to happen. So I walked to the corner of the room briefly and farted. I turned around. Chris is standing over me. I'm talking about 5 seconds. So he saw me move and was like, oh no, Krumholtz is moving. Fuck that shit. And came after me. And I farted. And he goes, what were you doing? And I said, I just farted. I had to fart.
Yeah.
And he goes, you farted? In the most snobby British, like, and I said, yeah, you can't even fart on this set, Chris, you bastard. We're not farting here. And he's like, get back on your mark.
Michael Lerner's playing my mom's husband. And we're shooting in this condo.
Yeah.
And now, look, dude, he's got a fucking trailer, like, in front of the place.
Okay.
And we're shooting in a condo. And it's like, you know, low budget, IFC. Right. We're just trying to get by.
I did an IFC show, by the way. But go on, so I know about it,
So, you know, the Video Village is in the bathroom of this condo.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And we're shooting in there. And then we, you know, there's a break. We all go out. And we come back, and Michael Lerner had shit in the Video Village. He had shit in the bathroom.
Okay.
That was the Video Village. He had a trailer right out front.
Oh.
And he just went in there and he shit. In my mind, it was like, just to let everyone know.
Michael Lerner's here.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
And he was also the guy that's like, can I keep this robe?
Yeah, of course.
What about these plants? Are they set? Everything.
What about these plants? Now, how do I keep them alive?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I fucking loved him, though. And he's also one of those guys who, like, poor Sally Kellerman, who was playing his wife, who was supposed to be my mother, she could not remember line for line. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Bobcat was shooting that one, and we had to shoot. He amazingly was able to do it just by giving her the line and keeping it, you know, just only using her shots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no group shots, because she couldn't do it. And Lerner is trying to sort of, like, we know each other. To her.
Yeah.
And she, you know, he would walk away and she goes, I don't think I like him. And like, because he was on every fucking TV show. He was also the guy that fucks with your head before each take so he can fucking shine. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we'd do scenes. He's like, you think you got this one?
Oh.
And action. Here we go. You know,
oh,
like,
Jesus.
Like, yeah. He was a real fucking piece of work. But
you know,
I loved it.
At the end
I
of
loved
the day,
it.
I love character actors. I love working with real character. I mean, the great thing about character actors and people like that is they're the punchiest. They've been through so much disappointment and fucking close to big things and never. They are punchy as they've been driven crazy.
But a lot of them are, you know, real kind of free spirited dude. Like what they want to be doing.
Absolutely.
You know, and like a lot of the guys, the character actors like this, they don't want the pressure. They just want to be that guy.
I want to be that guy.
Yeah.
I just want to be a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to be like, holy shit, that guy has so many fucking stories. And, you know, that's all I, you know, that's legendary shit, I think.
I think the great thing about you, though, as an actor, is that you're always, like, singular. Like, you know, you always hold the screen. You're not going to, you know, you're you, which is good.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I just...
But even the fucking Coen Brothers movie, which I love, like, I defend Hail Caesar constantly.
It's an amazing movie.
People don't fucking put it into the best Coen Brothers movies.
Well, because people don't understand what the movie's about. That it's a very inside movie.
I guess so. I just loved it. Like a double feature of that and Barton Fink.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a sequel.
I mean,
a prequel.
Hail Caesar is exactly what anyone in this business that really cares,
right?
The nerds, what they want to say, which is essentially that it's a job. And there's tons of glamour and glitz and gossip that surrounds it, but it's a fucking job. People wake up in the morning and do the shit. And the difference between the magic you see on screen and the take prior that got fucked up, which is what happens at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Clooney fucks up an amazing take.
Yeah.
Is minuscule, but it's enough to fucking, you know, make it so that you got to do it again and get it right.
And hundreds of people have to reset.
Correct. And what I've come to realize for myself is that this business is like the country divided down the middle. 50% nerds, 50% scumbags.
Yeah.
Failing upward talentless scumbags. That's what this is. Sycophantic, you know, talk the talk, barely can walk the walk scumbags. And 50% beautiful, earnest, nerd artists. And the problem now, and maybe this has always been the problem, is that sometimes the nerds become the scumbags, but the scumbags never become the nerds.
So it just adds more scumbags.
Yeah, and that the scumbags protect the scumbags. They protect each other, and the nerds don't do enough protecting of each other. Hmm. That's, to me, Hollywood in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And that's what that movie's about.
Yeah.
That's what that movie's about. In all truth, I didn't know that when I read it.
Yeah.
I couldn't gleam it. And I'll tell you what made me realize it. This is an amazing story.
Yeah.
I'm on the Hail Caesar set. It's lunchtime. I decide I'm not going to go to the lunch area. I'm going to sit and eat a sandwich from craft service on the set.
Yeah.
And the Coen brothers do the same thing. They're like off in another room on set, plotting out the next shot or after lunch or whatever. And the door to the stage opens and fucking Terrence Malick walks in. Okay, now Terrence Malick, major recluse, you know, legendary reclusive director, kind of considered a nut, amazing filmmaker, walks in. And I know it's him. And there's a young PA who runs over and goes, "Excuse me, sir, this is a closed set." And I go, "Hey, wait, this is Terrence Malick. You should let him on." And Terrence Malick just goes, "Hey, are the brothers here? And if they are, I'd love to talk to them." He comes over unannounced. He doesn't have an appointment with them. So they go and they have lunch together. He sits with the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And I know that's happening on the other side of the stage and whatever.
Yeah.
So after we come back from lunch, I walk up to Ethan Coen and I say, "That's crazy. Fucking Terrence Malick of all people just shows up and has lunch with you guys."
Yeah.
And Ethan turned to me and with complete truth, he said, "We're not that impressed by filmmakers." And in that moment, I thought, that's what the movie's about. Holy shit, that's what this movie's about.
Yeah.
You know, I needed that to happen for me to understand. I was just lucky to be, I just felt like I'm lucky to be in it. I don't really understand what they're getting at with this one. But I think that's the, you know, that's the reason that movie's so tragically underseen and not valued is people don't, you have to be in the business, I think, to really understand what
they're trying to say. Is that the same with Barton Fink? Maybe?
No, because Barton Fink is more of very much an existential crisis of a man type thing,
which is
relatable to, you know.
I just thought that the turn, like, I thought, like, Josh Brolin was amazing in Hail Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was carrying the whole thing, and it was really what you're talking about, the job of it.
Right.
And his need to protect not only the business, you know, from the top to where he is, but also the actors, and like he had to manage all the what you're saying. And he wasn't a douchebag.
No, and he was a good guy, except he, you know, he could get tough.
But he was struggling with himself.
Correct.
But you had that part, and you were hilarious.
Thank you.
And you had to make decisions in that moment because it was a big room, not a huge part.
Right.
And, you know, you were punctuating intensity.
You know, that's what they wanted. I showed up, they said, "Grow a full beard." So I did.
Yeah.
And then I showed up and they said, "Shave him completely." And I did. And then they looked at me again and said, "Slap a mustache on him." So I had the mustache.
Yeah.
They made me shave it. And then they were like, "Oh, no." Once the mustache was on, it was like, "Oh, I know exactly what I'm going to do."
But in terms of,
I'm just going to play the mustache, which is what I do in that movie.
That was your
just play
focus?
The mustache. Yeah. Just scrunch up my face and make the mustache look funny. That was really the whole job.
But what is it about them? Because I noticed I watched Ethan's movie that he did with his wife, the new one. It's different because it's half the Coens.
Right.
And there's a way that, you know, I don't know, I'll ask you, is it there a way of acting in a Coens movie or is it just the way they see it?
There's a very simple answer to that.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with acting.
Right.
It's eyes. They're big into sad eyes.
Really?
If you watch their movies, so many of their Turturro and Buscemi and Tony Shalhoub and sad eyes.
But
sad eyes. Very sad looking eyes. Expressively depressed sad eyes.
But they also have a unique sense of timing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they have a unique sense of a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I think you get cast for your eyes.
Huh.
I believe that.
You never, you haven't asked one of them?
No, I never went that far.
Hmm.
I was convinced the first couple days on Hail Caesar that Joel in particular hated me.
It seems like an easy thing to think about him.
Yes. We were at the craft service table one day and I thanked him for the job. I said, hey, thanks. You know, it means a lot to me. And he shrugged me off and I thought, oh, he hates me. But actually, I love Joel, and Joel came, you know, when we did the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, they were both wonderful. They're wonderful. They're hilarious and wonderful. And
did you like Serious Man?
I've never seen it. I don't watch a lot of things.
It's a Jew movie.
I know that. I think that's probably why I didn't see it.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I think you'd like it. I think it's funny.
You know, and I'm not going to lie to you. Jealousy is there, or was there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I heard, oh, it's a Jewish movie about a young Jewish, you know, guy.
Yeah,
and I thought, well, what the fuck? Yeah, and then Inside Llewyn Davis, you know, that.
You could have done that, too.
Well, I look a lot like Oscar Isaac, and I did at the time, certainly with a beard.
Yeah.
So much so that my lovely sweet dad was at home and a commercial popped up and he called me and he said, how come you didn't tell me you were in this movie?
Oh, really?
And I said, that's not me. So that one hurt, but I love Oscar Isaac. He's a wonderful actor.
I had to watch that one twice.
A really great person. Yeah. So.
I had to watch it twice to get it.
Yeah. It's you know. Yeah.
Well, it's a movie about grief.
Right. I don't think it's their greatest moment. I think Oscar Isaac is wonderful in it. But, you know,
when that hillbilly clocks him, though, and you find out why, it's
right.
A pretty good punchline.
True Grit is a great remake.
Yeah, I thought it was good, too.
And I love the old stuff. I mean, everybody talks about The Big Lebowski, but man, Raising Arizona.
Me, too. I'm not a Lebowski guy.
Yeah, no, I'm not that big a Lebowski guy either.
Almost every other one.
Right.
Over that one.
Correct.
For me.
I'm in the same. I like, I like the one with Tom Hanks, what's that one called? Not the Immortalist.
Oh, yeah, the one where he plays the dandy, the southern guy.
I kind of like that one a lot, too. So.
Yeah. So this one, this new one, Lousy
Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see it?
I did.
Really?
I watched it last night.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's great.
It's fun.
It's an interesting, a stylized thing. That guy has a vision.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to watch a director who commits to a vision.
You know, his whole thing is basically tearing down convention.
Yeah.
And that's all his films are, you know, that's true of all his films, is sort of, you know, going, oh, look at these filmic tropes.
Yeah.
And let's undo them somehow in a very almost breaking the fourth wall way. We know we're telling you a story. You know, you're watching it. There's no like, you're not supposed to be immersed in the film. You're supposed to go.
It's not natural.
Correct. And, you know, with this, he just took the trope of guy finds out he's going to die. He has 6 months to die.
Yeah.
And to live, I should say. And turned it on its head, which, you know, he came to me and I said, what if he's, you know, what I'm gleaming from this script when I read it and knowing him, I know Bob Byington, the director, writer, I know him really well.
Yeah.
I said, this is a movie about a guy who's thrilled when he finds out he's going to die.
Yeah.
He's actually relieved.
Yeah.
No one likes him. He's kind of a dick. This is like, you know, and he gets to keep it as a secret, like sociopathically. He really doesn't tell anybody except his ex-girlfriend that he's dying. Whereas most people would scream, I'm dying, to everyone.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps, it's his little fun secret that he keeps. And it allows him to be maybe take risks and behave a little differently and teach this lesson.
But not much.
Little bits. Like nothing changes.
He doesn't even go all the way with it.
Right. The idea that this big news comes into this guy's life and he doesn't change that much. And he doesn't change in the way most people would. To me, that's the brilliance of the film and what you're watching. That's the uniqueness of it.
Yeah, you know? I like the tone of it. I like that woman who plays your ex-girlfriend, too.
Olivia Thirlby?
Yeah, she's very good.
Yeah, she's really
Everybody
great.
Everybody was really good. Martin was good. Mm-hmm. Stephen Root's always
Stephen
nice
Root's
to see.
Great, yeah.
Stephen
Luxie
Root.
Banner, the girl who plays my student.
Yes, she's great.
Fucking great.
She's great.
And she, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. Loved her.
I like the tone, you know. It didn't take me long to get into it in terms of getting what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the college. It was funny. It was funny and it was weird.
It's weird and funny and working on it was a bit of a nightmare. We shot it in 15 days in Texas. Bob Byington.
Yeah.
Is a brilliant man who is so self-hating and deeply angry and embarrassed by himself.
Really?
Which, by the way, I totally relate to. But there were moments where you'd have to sort of rein Bob in as I've never had to rein in a director. A director usually reins me in.
Yeah.
In this case, I kind of had to say to Bob a few times, hey, be good to yourself, man.
Yeah.
You're wonderful. And this whole thing you do of like, I'm terrible and, you know, or I'm
saying that.
Yeah. Or I'm really angry at people. Like, don't put yourself, like, I get it. The self-deprecating thing, it works and then it doesn't. So at a certain point it becomes sort of half tragic.
Right.
And then, but I think he was doing that to get me to that place. He was sort of going, hey, not play me, but this is the conceit of the film and it's the conceit of the character. It's who he is. He's this guy
who, to have surrendered to self-hate.
Correct.
Right.
And so, you know, he was doing it to sort of, for me to emulate that, which you know, kind of him, but it also broke my heart a little bit. I mean, Bob Byington is a wonderful human being and he's heartbreaking on some level, but he's an amazing artist in that he is able to sort of put that heartbreak into words and into action. And there's something very, Lousy Carter is a funny movie. And it's a real simple bit.
Yeah.
Guy finds out he's going to die.
Yeah.
Finds out he's not going to die.
Right.
And yet there's a sadness to it. You know, there's a bit of like a melancholy, like, you know, what is life worth if you can just find out you're going to die and then you're not?
You like doing comedy though, don't you?
I do. I'm doing one right now, which is the craziest, and they're letting me do everything. And I, you know, you make these smaller movies and you like Lousy Carter or, and you just go, oh, I hope this is
excited about that? It's your movie.
I'm super psyched about it, but I've done five others have never been seen or that barely.
Yeah.
And you work your ass off on these things.
Yeah.
Late nights, long hours, no budget, treated like shit, fucking giving your all.
To just be part of the crew.
I did one with Natasha Lyonne. It's me and Natasha Lyonne.
It's
a movie called My Suicidal Sweetheart.
Yeah.
And no one saw that fucking film. And it's brilliant. And I worked my balls off on it.
Yeah.
So I'm doing one now, same thing. I'm just like, I just hope people see it. So the fact that Lousy Carter, the fact that I'm here talking to you and I get to promote it here is huge. Because it just means that, like, thank God it's going to be seen. You know, thank God, because I worked my balls off on it. You get paid nothing.
You know,
they're ultra low budget. You get paid like, you know,
it's amazing,
$100 a day.
So many movies like that I've been really moved by lately, you know, have been these smaller movies. Like I had Lily Gladstone in here. I didn't even want to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right.
I mean, she did a couple of Kelly Reichardt films where it's just like, holy fuck.
Right.
Even that movie, I did not watch Past Lives, which was nominated for it. And that's a little movie.
Right,
and
tiny.
It's fucking spectacular, you know, in terms of the weight of it.
Right. I haven't seen it because I don't watch anything. But I think this is the natural pendulum swing from years of superhero movies. And that's not knocking superhero movies. I love Marvel movies. I love them.
All of them?
Most of them. I make excuses for a lot of them.
Mm.
I love them because I grew up reading the comics and because the reason I don't watch anything is because I tend to get bothered by bad acting or bad lighting or I'm an idiot.
But
CGI movies, I have no idea how they do that shit. So I find them fascinating.
Yeah, some of them's better than others. I'll help you out here. There was an old comic named Steve Kravitz and he used to call the TV the resentment box.
Yeah.
So you can't watch.
No, I watch it and I go, my God, what the fuck? Like, how does this pass as anything valuable and good? And like,
have you gone in for Marvel movies?
I did go in for Spider-Man and I went in and I had a meeting for the Fantastic Four. And it didn't, I'm going to end up playing like a superheroes orthodontist in something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hope they keep me in mind because I am a huge fan but you know, so what? So what if I'm a fan? They have lots of fans, but I'd love to do something for them. I'd love to.
And when you work with you've worked with Downey a couple times, right?
Yeah.
And you work in Clooney,
correct.
He's hilarious, right?
Love Clooney. told me the greatest Bill Murray story ever.
Oh, really?
Can't repeat it.
Yeah, yeah. so, genuinely a nice guy.
Clooney, here's the deal. All the A-listers, the big A-listers that have worked forever, the only reason they work forever, I don't care how talented they are, they're good guys.
Yeah.
They're just sweethearts.
Yeah.
You got to be able, life's too short to work with an asshole. You got to be able to disarm your own sense of gorilla-ness on a set.
Yeah.
You know, when I first worked with Downey, we worked in Plymouth, Massachusetts in a small courtroom. All the
judge, right?
The judge.
Duvall, too, right?
The what?
Wasn't Duvall?
He's in there. I didn't work with him.
Oh.
But the room was filled with 50 local Plymouth extras who aren't really extras. They're just people.
Yeah.
And Downey shows up and takes a moment to shake each and every one of their hands. Because for him, he doesn't want to feel like the gorilla. He just doesn't want to feel like that. He doesn't want that.
Yeah.
And it makes it so that he can perform more freely and be the good guy he's striving to be.
Yeah.
And that's true of, like, I work with Brad Pitt and George Clooney and, you know, I'm not going to drop every name, but
Pitt's a nice guy.
Sweetheart. You know, sweetheart. Gave me a lot of, he hooked me up with a lot of weed.
Yeah.
Like, gave me weed.
Yeah.
Anybody that gives me weed is
they're good for you.
Yeah. mean, I don't smoke weed anymore, but but when I did, I smoked a lot of weed.
What happened? You just fell into yourself?
Okay. You want to hear something nuts?
Sure.
I have a rare disorder called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which
is that
a
Jewish
gaining.
Thing?
It might as well be. It's gaining attraction. Like, in other words, people are starting to report this, like on the news.
Yeah.
But essentially, I'm so deeply. I used to not be, but I've developed a wild allergy to weed that makes me, like, almost die every time I smoke it.
Whoa.
I've been to emergency rooms about 20 times as a result of.
What are the symptoms of that?
Nausea on a level I wouldn't wish on. So emesis, hyperemesis. Emesis is the medical term for nausea.
Okay.
So hyper nausea, if you can imagine what that is.
Yep.
You want to die. You want to die. It is outrageous nausea. You lose a crazy amount of weight. You cannot swallow a goddamn thing. Water. You get so dehydrated from throwing up and from not being able to
even if you're not continuing
fluids.
To smoke.
So how it works is if you smoke every day and you smoke a lot, it happens. Then you need to stop, and the next 3 to 4 weeks are torture. So you've stopped smoking, but it needs to somehow, and they don't know why. There's no research. No one knows why this is happening. The greatest information on it is a Facebook group called Cannabinoid Hyperemesis Syndrome.
Yeah.
And it's all survivors or family members of survivors of this thing. People have died from this thing.
There must be a lot of it because weed's legal.
Well, and they fucked up weed, man. Every pothead, there's not a single pothead that doesn't agree that on some level they kind of made it too strong. They kind of fucked it up. It's a little too strong now.
Yeah.
And in some cases, a lot too strong. It used to be you have a friend who hadn't smoked in a couple of years or never smoked.
Yeah.
And you're like, no problem giving him a hit and then just babysitting him a little bit, but he's going to be fine. Now, you know, people trip off the shit and bug the fuck out. And you're like, oh, shit, I wish I hadn't given you this hit. That's how it is now. And for some reason, with the strength of it now, this cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome is becoming way more prevalent. And I denied it. I thought it was bullshit when they first told me. I was like, come on. I thought something was wrong with me gastrointestinally or whatever.
Yeah.
I took every test in the book. I was clean as a whistle. And finally, I listened and said, okay, I'll stop smoking weed. And after about a month, it went away. And then I tried smoking weed again because I'm an addict and got sick again, stopped, went away. I tested the theory 4 different times and ended up in the hospital like 20 times. It's very real.
You're done.
Very fucked up and very
real.
You're
done until the next time you test
it. I don't miss it. No, I don't miss it.
Yeah.
I'm good. I have aversion syndrome at this point. It'll kill me.
Yeah.
It will kill me. I'll die of weed, which is a terrible way for anyone to die.
Not a great story.
Much less David Krumholz.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That'd be a bad way for me to die.
The Deuce. You were great in The Deuce.
Yes, you're correct.
And it's a kind of a great character, right? You must have been thrilled to have that character.
Oh, dude, the writing is great. You know,
Simon, right?
It's just rare that something's in your voice.
Yeah.
You know, part of the job of acting is trying to sort of, you're a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah.
But you got to find the happy medium.
Yeah.
But when it's in your voice, you can go to you can move mountains.
But to make that guy, I love that the empathy, you know, where you kind of have empathy for this, for the pornographer.
Oh, because absolutely.
He's like, it's a great character based on, you know, a reality.
You know, I rarely do backstory on characters. I don't believe in doing anything
that
actors do.
Yeah.
But I did one on that. And I was just like, his older brother's a doctor. His younger brother's a lawyer. They're super successful.
Yeah.
He was not smart enough to be either of those things. And he became a fucking porn guy because he's a horny little shit.
Yeah.
Who hung around the scene watching people get fucked and getting fucked himself.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's taken it in the ass 1,000 times. Maybe he's slightly gay. Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? But he's deviant.
Black sheep.
I've always wanted to play. To me, sexual deviance is unexplored comedic territory.
Yeah.
Like we haven't even, Happiness, that Todd Solondz movie, is the closest thing to exploring that from a comedic way.
Yeah.
And there's some tragedy to it too, but that's what's great about sexual deviancy. You know, the problem is you really can't do it, especially now. But sexual deviancy to me is hilarious. Woody Allen touched on it here and there.
You mean in his personal life?
Well, in the movies and then in his personal life,
Well, there's been a few, and it's always pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That one movie with Michael Fassbender is disturbing.
Which one is that?
It's about the sex addict.
Oh,
I forget what it's called, but Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Gnarly.
No, I mean, look, to me, you know, it's like Kubrick, right?
Yeah.
To me, every one of Kubrick's films is about human beings trying to deny their animal instincts. In every single way, whether it's the instinct of survival, Eyes Wide Shut is about sex, is about like, we're just sexual fucking creatures.
Yeah.
We can't fucking do anything about it.
Right.
And it's our ruination when it's not acceptable in the world.
Right, yeah.
And to me, there's a comedy version of Eyes Wide Shut that's yet to be made. You know, you can joke about it because it's innocent.
Yeah.
Sex is innocent. Our sexual urges are really genuinely innocent. The problem is they veer into dangerous territory sometimes.
Yeah,
For different reasons.
Yeah, correct. It's like the Wilhelm Reich, the guy who created the orgone box, and you know, was sort of this renegade lunatic protege of Freud's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his idea. He was sort of at the center of the psychology of the sexual revolution, because he thought that if Freud was right and all this sexual perversion is because of repression, if everybody just freed that and just started fucking, we would all, everything would level off.
And, you know, he's right.
Maybe. I think what ultimately happened, it's capitalized upon and you just have porn on your phone.
Correct.
Mm.
I'm in a movie about that. That doesn't get credit for being that movie, but it's literally, that whole movie is about it. And have you ever seen Sausage Party?
Oh, yeah. Right.
With the food orgy at the end. It's literally all of them going, life is meaningless. We get eaten. There's no point in hating on each other. And let's just all fuck. And the movie ends with a ridiculously disgusting and graphic orgy of food. That's what that whole movie's about. And to me, it's really profound. Way more profound than it got credit for.
Because
it's a movie about talking hot dogs.
Yeah. Scene you have in the one where you're hanging off the, what was it, the end? Is it called The End?
This is The End.
It's very funny.
Yeah, it was a good one. You can handle my whole weight. No, I was incredibly drunk in one of the scenes in that movie, and I regret it.
Mm.
I no longer drink, but I was doing this
scene.
You're
a sober
guy. They put me next to Rihanna.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wildly drunk. And she knew it, and I knew she knew it, and she was wonderful, and I wasn't mean to her, but I was just a drunk around her.
Yeah. You're so totally sober?
This is my way of apologizing to Rihanna. Yes, I'm totally sober. I mean, yes.
Good. I am too. It's been a long time. So, you're all right?
I'm okay. I'm very tired making this film, and I'm glad
to
do this.
The new one. Who's directing?
A young, wonderful, smart, brilliant guy named Caleb Alexander Smith. I hope people see it. It's called Forlock. You never know.
When's it going to be done?
I fucking don't know.
All right. Take care of yourself.
You rock. This was lovely.
It was.
You this was good.
There you go. David Krumholtz. He's exactly like you thought, right? Lousy Carter is in theaters tomorrow and also available on digital on demand platforms. Hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, Full Marin listeners can hear what goes on between me and my producer Brendan on this week's bonus episode. We both were interviewed for a documentary about podcasting, so we jumped on the mics to compare notes. She asked me questions about, you know, did you feel like you were doing a radio show? And I was like, not really. We knew we could do whatever we wanted, but we didn't know what that was or how it looked. And I brought up the point, which I don't think I'd brought up before really in thinking about it, which was that Morning Sedition, the show that we did on Air America, though structurally was a morning show, the effort that we put into segments and comedy was different. That we, you know, because we had writers on hand, because, you know, we had these options and we were workers, we did something pretty unique. So I think our sensibility around what we could do with audio was informed more by the freedom we had and what we did on Morning Sedition, which was not fundamentally morning radio.
Right, which was why it wasn't translating elsewhere. No one else wanted it because it didn't fit into the mold of what you were, what people were doing on radio shows.
Right, so we had that sensibility, and I was sort of, I brought that up, that like, no, we didn't, we knew we weren't doing radio. We were actively, you know, kind of taking advantage of the freedom to feel it out. And that was an interesting point, you know, and I talked about Morning Sedition. I talked a little bit, but she was asking me broader questions where she was like, could you explain to people who Rush Limbaugh is? I'm like, no. That bonus episode is up now for Full Marin subscribers. You get bonus episodes twice a week and all WTF episodes ad-free when you're signed up. To subscribe to the Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a little Bob Dylan. Don't tell him, though. Thank you.
Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels. Cat angels everywhere.